well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad you're with me on the program today. We're going to be talking with Matthew Hoy here in a minute or two. He is the author of Fact-Checking Frauds, How Fact-Checkers Distract, Deceive, and Distort Our Politics. Matthew gave me an excerpt from the book that ran on Bearing Arms yesterday, focusing on some of the bad fact-checking after the shooting at Robb Elementary in Uvalde, Texas in 2022. But this is something that, honestly, I've been dealing with throughout the entirety of my career covering the Second Amendment. We just have a lot of bad reporting on this issue. And in some cases, it's intentional. I think in some cases, it is definitely bias at work. In a lot of cases, it's reporters who don't know the first thing about firearms. But I got to say, I think more recently, I've noticed, I don't know if it's the reporters don't have as much time to spend on a particular story, or we're just seeing lazy reporters. But for instance, I saw a story, and this isn't a huge deal, but it's still wrong. Right. So there was a story from one of the Virginia TV outlets. I think it was based in Lynchburg. This is maybe a week or two ago. Talking about gun sales, you know, heating up in Virginia ahead of the July 1st a ban on assault firearms and large capacity magazines. And that part's accurate. But they referred to the gun ban bill as HB 21, which isn't the right bill. HB 21 is a gun control bill. In fact, Virginia Attorney General Jay Jones was talking about it on X yesterday because it is the bill that will allow Jones to investigate and sue gun makers, gun sellers, distributors, holding them responsible for the actions of criminals if he determines that anybody in the gun industry has, you know, violated some vague standards of conduct. Virginia is not the only state to have this law in place. In fact, sadly, the Supreme Court turned away a challenge from the National Shooting Sports Foundation to New York's almost identical law yesterday. That was one of the cases that was denied cert. And we're going to see more of these junk lawsuit bills emerge in blue states around the country. But again, they got it wrong. They got the bill number wrong. Not a huge deal in this case, but how many folks, A, are following gun control legislation closely enough in Virginia to know that they got it wrong? And secondly, if they're not going to be able to get the basic facts right, a bill number, what else are they not getting right? You know, it's easy enough, I think, for those of us who pay attention to Second Amendment issues, we pick up on these things, right? When there's a glaring error, we notice it because we've got the information right up here that allows us to spot something that's inaccurate. But what about the stuff we don't know about? How many news stories are we consuming over the course of a day or a week or a month that also contains bad information, or in some cases, outright misinformation, but we don't have that knowledge base to immediately pick up on, oh, that's not right? That's what concerns me, because there are a lot of Americans out there who are not gun owners. There are a lot of gun owners out there who are not Second Amendment advocates. And bad information can get absorbed very easily by these folks who are simply not aware of the facts and assume that the news they're taking in is accurate and can be taken at face value. So it's a great conversation with Matthew Hoy. It's a great book. I do encourage folks to check it out, but take a look and a listen to our conversation right now. Matthew, thanks so much for coming on the program. It's good to see you, sir.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Well, I appreciate the piece that you adapted from your book for Bearing Arms. The book itself is called Fact-Checking Frauds, How Fact-Checkers Distract, Deceive, and Distort Our Politics. It is out now. And I want to ask, I mean, what made you decide that this was a topic that you wanted to take on?
Well, you know, I started out in journalism long, long time ago. I was a former newspaper reporter. People ask, why don't you do, you know, why aren't you working for newspapers anymore? I tell them, well, do you get a newspaper at home? And they say, no. I say, that's why I'm not working in newspapers anymore. But, you know, I care about the media. I care about journalism. I was one of the kind of, you know, lots of journalists go into the media in order to change the world. They're politically liberal. I went into journalism because I was a pretty good writer. And that was kind of the start and end of it. I was politically conservative. When I started out, I really wasn't a gun guy. But I wrote this because I saw fact-checking and I saw how it was being used and, frankly, weaponized. And they just weren't doing a good job. One of the first, you know, kind of fact checks that I criticized and, you know, did some work on was PolitiFact said that John Boehner, when he promised not to use military transports back and forth to his district, like Nancy Pelosi had done at the cost of millions of dollars, PolitiFact went and did a fact check and said, oh, this is, it's unclear whether he's telling the truth. And I was just kind of befuddled because these are supposed to be the really good fact checkers, the ones at PolitiFact, the ones at the Washington Post. And this reporter, who was apparently a pretty new reporter, none of her editors had taken her aside and said, look, here's why John Boehner made this promise. It's because Nancy Pelosi was using military transports, costing a lot of money. How was that discovered? Well, Tom Fitton over at Judicial Watch did a FOIA and found out this information. And she didn't do that with John Boehner. So I did. I was working at the Union Tribune at the time. I wasn't a reporter there. I would design newspaper pages. And I went and filed a Freedom of Information Act request. And there was, it turns out, he was telling the truth. He had not been taking military transports back and forth. And I went and sent her an email and told her that. And she was really concerned. She was, why didn't you come and tell me this? Why did you go and do this on your own? And I was kind of shocked a little bit by it because I'm not your editor.
Right.
I could be your editor. I think at this point it's clear I do a better job than your editor, but my job isn't to do your work for you. It's to hold you to your standards. And frankly, a lot of fact-checking standards, you know, they claim to, you know, be high and mighty and claim to hew to high standards, but they don't. They just don't.
They don't. You're right. Which brings us to the piece that you adapted from your book, talking about the shooting in Uvalde and the fact-checking or the supposed fact-checking of a statement by Chris Murphy. He was talking on CNN with Aaron Burnett, and he claimed that most of these killers tend to be 18 or 19 years old. You say that PolitiFact looked at the evidence and decided that Murphy's statement was mostly true because, as they wrote, that's largely accurate when looking at school shootings alone, according to a Washington Post database of school shootings since 1999. The database did include shootings that did not result in a death, and the share of teenagers committing mass shootings overall is smaller. You took a look at that database as well, though, and again, you came up with a very different conclusion than PolitiFact, right?
Yeah, Chris Murphy, one of the things that PolitiFact especially makes a big deal out of is what someone's words are, what a politician says matters. What their words are matters, and that's the most important thing. Chris Murphy didn't say that most shooters were 19 years old or younger. He said they were 18 or 19 years old. And that school, that database they refer to, if you look at the age of the shooters, the 18 or 19 years old were smaller. It was a much smaller number. And he said killers was the other thing. He didn't say shooters. So if they're a killer, somebody's got to die.
Right.
Right. So that number was even smaller. And I'm not sure if I hope that the fact checker didn't realize what he was doing, because then it then you can kind of wave it off as, you know, incompetence or something like that. If he did, that's malpractice. That's journalistic malpractice, because the numbers are much smaller. They boost Chris Murphy's claim because, frankly, they kind of agree with the politics. That's what they would like to see politically.
Yeah.
Most of the school shooters, if you look at the average age, most of the school shooters are like 16 on average. Some are younger, some are older.
Right.
But the average is 16. And 16-year-olds can't buy firearms in this country. So Chris Murphy's saying 18 or 19 years old because he wants to put the minimum age at buying a firearm up to 21 or maybe even higher. That's mm-hmm. kind of where he is politically. And that, you know, and PolitiFact comes in and aids and abets that.
You know, I've dealt with this before as well. Oftentimes, you know, it'll be a statement, not even a particular fact check, but just a statement in a newspaper or, you know, online. Somebody, broadcast media, someone will say after a high profile shooting that, you know, AR-15s are the weapon of choice. When the FBI, or excuse me, the Secret Service put out a report, I think it was just last year, showing that actually, no, handguns are the most common firearm used in active shooting incidents. But again, it advances that agenda, right? Well, we want to ban these assault weapons, mm-hmm. quote unquote. So if it feels true, then maybe it's okay. And that brings me to this question, Matt. I mean, do the facts even matter in this environment? And we still have fact checkers. But I've run across this time and time again where people, you know, are presented with the real facts and they say, well, those don't matter because it doesn't match my worldview. And so I'm going to disregard reality in favor of, you know, my feelings.
Yeah. I mean, I remember the New York Daily News front page after the Washington Naval Yard shooting. It said like same gun, different sleigh or something like that. And, you know, pictured an AR-15, the guy had used a shotgun. So do the facts matter? The facts should matter. We should care about that sort of thing. But there's a lot of emotional investment. And this is kind of where I, you know, come down with the how fact checkers are distorting our politics. If they told the truth, we could have a different discussion. We could have a more fruitful discussion, but they aren't interested in telling the truth. They're interested in shaping the debate. You know, we talk about, okay, what are ways, you know, especially like red flag laws, you know, they promote those incessantly without a care for the due process considerations. I'm not sure how the best way to solve all of those are, but I think it's a problem. They just gloss over it. And so it's you know, they're distorting our politics in a number of ways by simply not telling us the truth all the time.
So how do we fix this?
That's the $64,000 question. Well, the first way to fix it is to not treat their pronouncements as settled law or settled truth.
Yeah.
You know, I've got a whole section in the back of the book on things that you should be looking for when we're talking about, especially kind of subjects in the public debate that are very contentious. I talk about a few of them: guns, abortion, climate change. On those sorts of subjects, you really need to look at their sources, and helpfully, a lot of them put their sources down at the bottom of the article. And you'll see, okay, who have they talked to? Who have they had email interviews with, but don't appear in the text of the fact check? And sometimes that tells you a lot. Mm. You know, and they don't try this so much with guns, but they do sometimes with the environmental stuff. is they'll talk to somebody who, you know, let's say they send an email to Costas Morris of the Second Amendment Foundation. And then he's never, anything he says never appears in the text of the article itself. That shows you that they're hiding something. The other thing is, you know, it's like, who, what experts do they contact? Another part of the book that didn't make, that isn't part of your adaptation was they fact-checked the governor of Texas, Greg Abbott. And Greg Abbott had suggested that, in his opinion, 18 to 20-year-olds being part of the people should have, you know, will have the legal right to purchase AR-15s. Now, this is very contentious, but the law is kind of moving in his direction. PolitiFact does this whole big fact check where they consult a legal scholar whose predictions on what the Supreme Court would say the Second Amendment says have been wrong over the past decade plus. He's not, you know, he's not like Alan Beck. He's not like Dave Koppel.
Right.
And then use basically his opinion to say Greg Abbott's mostly false. Well, this is a developing area of law, and it completely ignores the fact Greg Abbott's a lawyer. He was the Texas Attorney General before he became governor. But they treat him like he's a legal novice with no experience, and just set, and pick their sides.
Yeah,
and that's the sort of thing that goes on that you've really got to keep an eye out on.
Yeah, and it's, I mean, you know, it's tough because we want to be able to, you know, go online and read a news story and, you know, trust that what we're getting is the facts. But you have to ultimately, I mean, what you're saying is you got to be your own fact checker, right? Yeah. You cannot just assume that what you're reading is the truth. You have to do some due diligence. And what's really scary to me, Matt, is that, you know, we've got fewer and fewer Americans who I think are reading at even a, you know, sixth grade level. The TikTokization of media, you know, we're seeing these short form videos. Mm-hmm. And we're not, I think many of us are just, you know, accepting that information that comes in a deluge, right? First of all, we've got a fire hose of information directed mm-hmm. our way if you spend time online. So it is difficult to fact check everything that you hear. That is time consuming. But I'm afraid that we are developing a complacency towards the information that we receive, and that we're not skeptical enough, and we're not doing the due diligence that we need to do as consumers of media. And it's why I think, you know, conspiracy theories are taken off. It's why, you know, the most outlandish stuff that gets said is taken at face value by, you know, let's say 10-15% of the population, right? Maybe not enough to win an election, but enough to concern you. I mean, we're still talking about millions of people who are buying into whatever it is that they're told. And that's, I think that's downright dangerous for a free society.
Yeah. I mean, 10-15% of the people won't, you know, that won't get someone elected, but that can tilt the election from one side to the other.
Absolutely.
Really easily. You know, I've done substitute teaching for the past few years and at public schools. And I tell you, it scares me. It really does. I'm not sure. You'll go into an English class and the kids, you ask a kid, you know, what are you reading on the side? Nobody's reading anything on the side. They're watching TikTok videos. The number of kids who, you know, can sit there, oh, yeah, when they've got free time, and the number of kids who pull out a book in a class of like 35 is one or maybe two. And I don't care what kind of book it is.
Right.
I just want you to be great if it's my book. But I just want you to pick out, you know, be reading, be learning, be knowledgeable, be informing yourself. It's the future is scary. I'm not sure what the solution is. You know, it's in the high schools and in education, I think getting rid of cell phones would be a great thing. I think getting rid of even the Chromebooks, you know, the internet, and having those as class sets in the front of the classroom rather than issuing one to every student. Mm-hmm. So they've got it out all the time. I can't tell you the number of times I've been walking around a classroom. They're starting to, they're supposed to be looking at stuff and they're watching YouTube videos on soccer or basketball or auto racing or, you know, something like that. I don't know what the solution is. I really don't.
Well, I'm right there with you. I don't either. I've been a little encouraged because there has been this trend on YouTube of people who are actually reading books on YouTube, and they're going through these books and wow, and you know that I think is maybe getting some members of the younger generations to think about reading in a in a new light, and I think reading is it's instrumental to developing critical thinking skills. And you know, so long term, I'm not really optimistic, but I think your book is a great roadmap for folks who do want to be, again, not overly critical of the media, but again, they for folks who want to know that what they're reading is accurate or not. There's some great advice on, again, how to make sure that you're doing that. And then so many examples of the media just failing to do its due diligence. It's a fantastic read. Where can folks find the book, Matt?
Find the books on Amazon. You can order at your local bookstore. Amazon's probably easier. Audiobook is also available on audible.com and Apple Audiobooks.
Okay. Fact-checking frauds, how fact-checkers distract, deceive, and distort our politics. Tell me about the Hoy Story On Air podcast, if you will, too.
That's just kind of where I rant and rave about whatever catches my fancy. I try and do it at least a couple times a week. I put up shorts on YouTube that are, you know, under 3 minutes, that are a little more geared towards the younger generation. I'm not sure how many of them watch those, but I talk about, you know, politics and media, especially the media. My last one, I believe, is on Scott Pelley getting fired from CBS. And frankly, I just add that to my list of things journalists can get fired for, is telling your boss you're murdering the program. Because I worked in journalism 15 years. It seemed like more reporters should be fired more often. And so the list of things that get you fired is something I kind of keep track of.
There you go. Well, Matthew, thank you so much for being a part of the program today. I really appreciate it. And it was good to meet you virtually. I look forward to talking to you again soon.
Thanks for having me.
My thanks again to Matthew for joining us on the program. Tomorrow, by the way, William Kirk from Washington Gun Law is going to be with us. We're going to be talking about a new bill in Washington State that punishes drunk drivers with the lifetime loss of their gun rights, but allows them to get behind the wheel of a car, which is a head scratcher to me. Before we get to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report, I want to talk about this for a second. From city streets to mountain trails, your gear should go wherever life takes you. And that is why at Modern Rugged Leather, every bag is handcrafted from premium, responsibly sourced leather. It's designed to look sharp, last long, and tell a story of its own. My Modern Rugged bag actually went with me to Massachusetts this past weekend. Charlie Cook from Riding Shotgun with Charlie gave me a ride to the airport on Sunday. I did get to ride shotgun with Charlie, and I'm loading up my bags in the trunk, and he says, "Do you have your Modern Rugged bag?" I said, "I certainly do." Showed it off. He was quite envious. So you can get yours. All you have to do, go to modernrugged.com. Every stitch, every buckle, every strap reflecting timeless craftsmanship, and it's backed by a lifetime warranty, because quality shouldn't quit when the adventure begins. So whether it's the boardroom or the back roads or maybe the back bay of Boston, Modern Rugged Leather helps you carry confidence every step of the way. Now, right now, the Modern Rugged website is undergoing a revamp. So if you go to modernrugged.com, you'll see a homepage that's relaunching soon with a new look and new product lines. You can sign up and be the among the first to know when the new website launches and those new designs are available to purchase. Just go to modernrugged.com. That's modernrugged.com. And again, you soon will be able to shop the full collection and find yours at modernrugged.com. All right, let's turn our attention now to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our Armed Citizen story. First, though, we'll get to the recidivist report. This from Austin, Texas. Austin man accused of sexually motivated break-ins at three West Campus apartments. Turns out this is not the first time this individual has been accused of sex crimes. According to KXAN, the suspect allegedly exposed himself, masturbated in front of victims, and in one case attacked and strangled a woman after she woke up to find him in her room. 30-year-old Octavius Brown was arrested on June 10th. Right now he's been charged with three counts of first-degree felony burglary of a habitation with intent to commit another felony after police in Austin, Texas, linked him to a series of incidents that occurred in the West Campus neighborhood. According to the affidavit, the incidents began around 4:28 at an apartment building. Two residents told police they believed a man, later identified as Brown, entered the secured and locked apartment building through a partially open window. One resident woke up to find the suspect standing inside his room. Another encountered him in a common kitchen area, allegedly masturbating with his pants removed. He was confronted by a resident who was armed with a knife, and then Brown allegedly took off running. About an hour later, officers dispatched to another burglary call not far away. Woman told investigators that she woke up in her dorm room to find a man exposing himself and masturbating while pulling her shorts down. Victim yelled at the man, and he fled. According to court records, she managed to photograph the suspect, though, as he left the room, which was pretty good thinking. Then, a couple hours later, about 7:30 in the morning, police got another call from a dorm just within a block of the other incidents. According to that affidavit, a woman woke up to find a man standing in her room. His pants were pulled down. She told police that the suspect climbed onto her bed, claimed to have a gun, demanded that she remove her shirt. When she resisted, he allegedly pulled at her clothing and then strangled her to the point that she thought she was going to pass out. She fought back by gouging the suspect's eye with her thumb, hitting him with a fan before he fled. So based on the photograph that one of the victims was able to take and surveillance footage, they were able to identify Brown. He was sitting on a bench wearing clothing that matched the suspect's description. He initially denied being in any residence there, but later admitted entering all three buildings while under the influence of methamphetamine. According to KXAN, court records show that Brown told detectives he had been released from jail back in April, was participating in sex offender rehabilitation at the time of the alleged offenses, said that he had relapsed, and was driven by a, quote, instinctual desire to have sex. Now here's where the recidivist report comes in. According to court records, Brown was released from the Travis County Jail in March after receiving a 5-year deferred adjudication community supervision sentence following a negotiated plea of guilty for a felony indecent exposure in 2024, which took place in the same neighborhood. In other words, he copped a plea deal offered by prosecutors, plead guilty to this felony, and we'll make sure you don't go to prison. You'll get 5 years of probation. The affidavit in this most recent case notes that Brown was convicted of Class B misdemeanor indecent exposure in 2017, felony indecent exposure in February of this year. So, I gotta say, I'm awfully confused. If he was released in March of last year, he was convicted, March of this year. Oh, I guess that was the felony indecent exposure. That was it. In February, he's convicted. In March, he gets the 5-year plea deal. According to court records, though, he has also accumulated about 30 different criminal cases dating back to 2013. 10 of the 12 felony charges and 4 misdemeanors filed against Brown since 2021. 9 of them ultimately dismissed or rejected by Travis County prosecutors. 2013, pled guilty to a burglary of a vehicle, got 2 years probation, which was later revoked, by the way. He was sentenced to 296 days in jail. Charge of engaging in organized criminal activity in 2013 was dismissed. 13 misdemeanor charges between 2014 and 2017, including 8 counts of indecent exposure, unlawful carrying of a weapon, public lewdness. 2018, failure to comply with sex offender's duty to register, a state felony, punishable by up to 10 years. He was convicted. He got 90 days in jail. 2021, felony unlawful carrying of a weapon. Case was rejected by Travis County prosecutors. 2023, failure to comply with sex offender duty to register with previous conviction, which is another felony. Case was rejected by prosecutors. second-degree felony sexual assault. Case was dismissed by prosecutors. Pled guilty to burglary of a building with intent to commit sexual assault. It was reduced to it's a felony charge, but it was reduced to a misdemeanor as part of the plea deal. He was sentenced to 195 days in jail with 196 days of credit applied, so time served. And it just goes on and on. Every time prosecutors in Travis County, Texas have had the opportunity to put this guy behind bars, they have instead either dismissed these cases, they've taken a plea deal that results in nothing more than probation and time served, and he's quickly back out on the streets. This is infuriating. And Octavius Brown, innocent until proven guilty of these most recent crimes. But based on his past criminal history, it is clear that Mr. Brown has victimized multiple individuals. And it is pretty clear to me that that will be the case, excuse me, as long as Mr. Brown is out in public. And yet, again, prosecutors just refuse to do anything about this when they have the opportunity. All right, on to today's Armed Citizen story from Florida. Florida mother shoots alleged home intruder during Palm Coast home invasion, according to deputies. We don't have nearly as much information about this story as we do about Mr. Brown and his criminal history, but here is what we know. Authorities say it was about 1:50 in the afternoon, I believe Monday afternoon, when a Palm Coast mother shot a man who allegedly forced his way into her home and threatened her and her children and then refused to leave. Deputies responded after Courtney Price called 911 and reported that she had shot a man who had entered her home. When deputies arrived, they found blood at the scene, but the man had already taken off in a vehicle. Investigators say that 33-year-old Michael McDonald entered Price's home. This was a Sunday afternoon. Excuse me, this was Monday. After apparently opening the garage, he banged on windows and then eventually came in through the front door. Price told deputies that McDonald demanded money, threatened her family, continued advancing after she warned him that she was armed, repeatedly told him to leave, warned that she would shoot, and when McDonald continued advancing towards her, she fired a single shot, striking him in the arm. McDonald then fled the scene. They located the vehicle that he was in at a local hospital where they conducted a felony traffic stop and detained him. He was treated for non-life-threatening injuries. Price and her children were not injured. Police say that McDonald was known to the homeowner through his sister, apparently. And Price said, quote, "I did what I had to do to protect my children and myself." She said she became afraid. He allegedly threatened her and her two sons. She said, "I panicked. I got my gun, and that was the first time using it." She said she warned McDonald to shoot if he didn't leave, but instead he kept walking towards her. He said, "I don't care. Shoot me." And that's when she pulled the trigger. She said, "I wasn't trying to kill anybody. I was trying to get him out to where my kids and I were safe in the house." Now, I'm sure know this already, but that's the one area that I would tell Ms. Price, listen, if you have to pull the trigger to protect yourself and your kids, you shoot to stop the threat. You don't shoot to wound. You don't shoot to injure somebody in the hopes that they're going to turn and run. Because what would have happened had this guy, instead of turning and running away, become enraged and then grab the gun? Use it against you. I understand. You don't want to take a life. But if you are in a position where you are genuinely afraid for your life and for the lives of your kids, you shoot to stop the threat. You don't fire a warning shot. You don't aim for their foot or a non-vital area, again, in the hopes that they're going to suddenly see reason once they've been wounded and then turn and run, because that might not happen. You're not in control of what they do. You're not in control of them coming towards you, and you cannot be assured that you're going to make them turn and run. In this case, it worked out for Ms. Price. That isn't always going to be the case. So I'm glad that she's okay. But again, I think in the situation like that, if you're going to act in self-defense, again, you act to stop the threat. All right, finally today, our good deed of the day in the right place at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. Several neighbors in Fort Wayne, Indiana, who were able to pull a woman from her burning home. Boy, we see a lot of these cases around the country, don't we? It's terrifying. Sierra Dubose, who is the president for the Mount Vernon Park neighborhood, said it was just a true community effort. DeBose says the neighborhood is tight-knit, a place where block captains are just steps away. Neighborhood even has the motto, neighbors helping neighbors. And that was the case on Saturday night when the Fort Wayne Fire Department was called out to a house fire. When crews arrived, they found heavy flames and smoke coming from the attic of the home. Firefighters had to use multiple hose lines, cut multiple access points in the roof to put out the blaze. There was nobody in the home at the time. The crews learned later that there was an older woman who was trapped inside but was able to escape without injuries thanks to several neighbors in the area. Sierra DeBose was about a block away from where the fire started, but she quickly ran towards the home. She said all you could see were these neighbors coming from every block just trying to see what was going on and how they could help. Adrian Chipras lives next door to the home that caught fire, was one of many people who helped rescue her. He told WANE TV that his dad had alerted him of the fire, was trying to put it out of the water hose. Chippers himself called 911, then ran over to the home with about five or six other neighbors. They started throwing rocks at the windows to break one. And when one of the windows finally shattered, Adrian Chipmus moved some of the bigger glass shards out of the way before actually going inside the home, which was already filling up with smoke. He was able to pick up the elderly woman and then carry her to safety. He said he was kind of just going on instinct, was just thinking about getting her out of danger. He said that he had met the woman at least once before. She had actually fallen in her home, and he had helped her then as well. DeBose said another neighbor comforted the woman until an ambulance came, and DeBose credits the community's closeness with the rapid response from neighbors. She says, you know, a lot of neighborhoods in the southeast side of town, people just kind of don't mingle. They don't talk to their neighbors. It's just not like that here. I would like to think that, again, you don't necessarily need to know your neighbor to help your neighbor in need. But regardless, I'm glad that in this case, this woman could rely on the kindness of her neighbors during her moment in need. All right, that is going to do it for this edition of Barry and Arms, Cam and Company. Again, I want to thank you very much for being part of the program as always. Be sure to check out BarryandArms.com today, keeping you up to date on all of the latest Second Amendment news and information from all across the nation. And again, Washington Gun Law's William Kirk will be with us on the program tomorrow, talking about one of the newest gun control bills, or one of the newest gun control laws, excuse me, in Washington State. So be sure to tune in for that. Appreciate William joining us bright and early on the West Coast, by the way. Enjoy the rest of your 2A Tuesday. We'll see you back here tomorrow. Until then, be well. Be safe. And be free.